Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 50, titled Emptiness of Emptiness.
In the Tibetan tradition, behind all Buddhas, behind all Buddhas, when you usually see pictures of the Buddha, there tends sometimes to be three things above his head, three lineages. And on his right hand, on the left side of those paintings, is what they call the Magnificence Deeds lineage. And what that is from Maitreya, future Buddha, who nowadays is believed to be in the Tushita paradise, the fourth heaven of the desire realm, in a Dharma center there, because it's not the whole heaven. The other deities in that heaven are, you know, they're like jacuzziing out, you know. But he has a Dharma center there called Su Manohara, you know, captivating, mind-captivating, where some of those deities and many human people are living there and they're studying and they're meditating. It's like a Dharma center. And then beneath that is Asanga, the sort of St. Augustine of Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism, 4th century, 5th century, same time as St. Augustine in the Mediterranean area. And then all the teachings about the relative reality are there. And on his left side, Buddha's left side, the right-hand side of the picture, there is Manjushri, the wisdom of all Buddha, transcendent wisdom of all Buddhas manifest, so to speak. And beneath him, Nagarjuna. And then everyone called the profound view lineage, the view of emptiness, of selflessness, of the profound nature of reality. And then those two come together, you know, like the idea is in a Buddha's heart. And directly above is called the direct practice lineage, and those are the meditators. And they're sort of, often they're just many Manjushris in a sort of meditative pose and other kinds of yogi types and siddhas, you know, mahasiddhas. But today we're talking about the two sides, the sort of relative reality side and the ultimate reality side. Because the interesting thing about emptiness, as we explained last time, yesterday, is that emptiness does not leave you in a state where it's all empty. Like, wrongly sometimes people feel if you have an experience where things seem to melt into empty space, which you can definitely have, and is a valuable, actually, an important experience, as long as it's not misinterpreted. And that experience, however, that is not the realization of emptiness, actually. What that is a kind of threshold of the realization of emptiness, where the things that seem to be solid and differentiated melt into sort of this vast space sort of thing. But then the space itself is not there obstructing the previous relative things that you perceive. The space itself is the space wherein all the relative things are. And that emptiness and that space is empty of itself, which is expressed by saying emptiness of emptiness or voidness of voidness. So a state of being apart from the world is itself empty because it's also a relational state. It's a state into which you departed through a certain diamond-like concentration. But you don't stay in that separate state, because that, since it's separate, it has a boundary between it and the rest of the reality, even though that boundary was an experience of the rest dissolving. But then the deep wisdom has the space itself dissolve. And when space dissolves, it's filled up with things again. So there you are back again with all the beings. And now you know that they're all there like an illusory, in an illusory way, not just total illusions or totally non-existent, but in an illusory way, in the sense that you know, if you try to bear down and pinpoint this is the real thing, that is the real thing, the other is the real thing, it will disappear. You know, it'll keep coming apart with your diamond-like, diamond-cutting, transcendent wisdom's critical analysis meditation. You know, it'll drill down through that And then the final thing to drill down is you drill down through the experience of being separate from all of that, of a state of being apart from all of that, which unfortunately too many people get stuck and trapped in, and they think, oh, I realized emptiness because I thought emptiness was this space, so I spaced out. So therefore now I can just hang out, and then when I die, I'll stay spaced out. And then they go around acting like they need a Cadillac or a Rolls Royce or a BMW, or they should have a Dharma center, and they should be worshipped and respected as enlightened people, so they tend to behave badly, actually. And that's a terrible mistake. That's called in Zen, in Zen, the wonderful, in English translation I know by the great Thomas Cleary, it's called being trapped in the demon ghost cave. And it's why in that famous Zen story, where for 20 years this one disciple had come to the master, and the master would then say to him, say something about emptiness or get out. And for 20 years he jumped out, you know, he went out of the room. And then one day he came and he said, the master said, as ever, say something about emptiness or get out. And he was stammering to say something, and he was pushing back against the master to stay in and say something. And the master pushed him out, slammed the door on his leg and broke his leg. Which is supposed to mean crazy wisdom. But note, he didn't break his leg for 20 years. Just that one time. And then, but that one time, you see, that's because the guy had actually had this spaced experience, finally, a really profound one. And he thought he had a hold of emptiness, you see. So the leg was a shock. It broke it, brought him back into relational reality, which is where he'd always been and where everyone always is always going to be. There's no escape whatsoever, enlightened or unenlightened. Even Buddha doesn't escape. But the difference is Buddha doesn't need to escape because he really enjoys being in the world, even with all of us who are very obnoxious and irritating to him, might be. But he still likes it because it's all bliss to Buddha. So the key point about emptiness is not that everything is empty in some sort of spaced out way, but that everything is relative and relational. And therefore, when you realize that emptiness, then you realize that the way you are in relativity, you have some responsibility. You are the creator of the way of being. You have the choice of how to be in relative reality. Of course, you connect to others and they are also choosing. So the sort of mutual intersection of all of the choices of all of the beings is how relative reality is structured. Do you follow? And so it's not like solipsism where you can just imagine everything is just hunky-dory and it will be. Not like that. It's that you and Buddhas and non-Buddhas are all imagining a certain thing, and the intersection of those imaginations is what creates the way the world is. And that's why language is so incredibly important. And of course, at the deepest level, language is mantra, meaning it creates things. You know, it shapes things. It shapes this relativity. So the realization of emptiness actually puts the burden of responsibility upon your mind and your being and your knowledge of language to shape the reality. And then that shaping of the reality is what is sort of elaborated most beautifully in the magnificent deeds lineage, the one from Maitreya, the future Buddha, and Asanga, and then many, many masters in India and Tibet and East Asia and everywhere. Like Nagarjuna and them are just pushing the reality thing, the emptiness thing, which liberates your thing. And then it's up to you to love that universe, the relational universe, which, of course, you put your absolute energy into doing when you realize you can't get away from it. Therefore, you have to make it into something blissful for yourself and others. And also, you can't really be blissful yourself if everybody else is in hell and misery, because they'll bother you. Right? They will inevitably bother you. You get it? You understand? So, there is a role for the imagination, is what I'm trying to say. In other words, it's all very well to drill down to find the reality. But then, even in the exoteric, not only in the tantra, where you really go deep into the ways of reshaping the relative reality, rebuilding the universe in a mandalic way into a place that is totally enriching and totally fruitional for all beings. But also, in the exoteric also, there's a way of re-envisioning the universe. For example, our materialist culture, stop to think. Poor Carl Sagan, he was an exit in his future life. I mean, he might still be involved in it. He might be down there in one of those SETI antennas, you know, and they broadcast, send out Beatles music and Mozart and Beethoven and stuff, hoping to someone else would hear it and send back their version, Alpha Centauri's Beatles and Mozart. And I don't know, you know, hear back from Alpha Centauri, can't get no satisfaction. Then everything is cool. Oh, there's somebody else out there. But still there's no response. It's all silent. And you look out in space, and it's cold out there. The only thing that ever came across was Mrs. Alien, clamped on outside the spaceship. Remember, Sigourney was coming back, and Mrs. Alien was out there. She's the only one who could survive the empty space, all cold. And the stars are these burning orbs of supernova flames, you know, that happened millions of years ago. Nobody can live out there. So we're all alone. And they have this little skin of, some tiny little skin of the mantle of Earth over boiling lava. And then above, the atmosphere runs out. You can't breathe. And then David Koch is pumping it full of carbon. And the Chinese are pumping it full of carbon. And will we survive? No. Well, luckily, though, all we have to do is die, and then we won't know what's happening. So then we'll be just fine. That's how we'll escape. But it's this terrible, boring, freaked-out universe. We're all alone, and there's no point to it also. And why did they even why are we even conscious? It was an accident. Some amino acids jumped up and down, and they went bloop, bloop, and then there was a frog and a fish and whole thing, and then a monkey, and then a missing link, and a few things. And then Darwin, and so then here we are, and there's no point to the whole thing. And so, you know, if it gets too bad, no need to sit there at the wall and zen for 10 years. Just shoot yourself, and then you disappear. You don't have to wait to meditate to disappear. You can just disappear. It's the only solution. That's our world. No wonder Prozac is a super bestseller. Barrels of it are being sold because we're taught this depressive vision of the relative world. And nothing we do is really going to make a difference. And even we big Zenis or Vipassanites or Tibetan Buddhists or Hindus or whatever we are, Jews or Jubus or Crispus or Hindus, Shambus, whatever we are, you know, on our other reality sense, you know, we have all these ideas, but then, you know, we get something, they say, oh, you have like a tumor in your leg, ankle there. Well, we should amputate or something. Oh, yes, doctor. And we rush off to hospital and they haul us away because our faith is still there in the materialist science because we learned that those guys know about reality. We don't want to think that they're totally nuts, actually. In fact, because they think they've discovered nothing. Since the 18th century, finally they discovered nothing became modern and became existentialists. And they realized it all doesn't matter, so don't really worry so much, and there's no hell, and there's no future life. And then even people today are telling us that's what Buddha thought. Ridiculous business. There's no escape. Nobody gets out of here by dying. So you better get it together. That's the purpose. The purpose is to make sure you can book a happy next life. Book the happy, like just like you're booking the happiness of this life. You booked your room at Mela. You book your retirement. You have long-term disability insurance. You have whatever, life insurance. You're booking all things, nice things. So you have to keep booking. And how do you book your future life? They say that your future life, if you want to know your future life, you don't have to go to the astrologer, although he can help. But you don't have to go. All you have to do is look at your mind right now. Your mind, it will create how your future life will be. If you look at your mind and you find a lot of weird bubbling and boiling and strange things in there, and you're unconscious, if you find, you can't just sit around. That's also a difference of Buddhist psychology and modern psychology. Modern psychology says unconscious is automatically and forever unconscious, will always be unconscious. That's just the nature. You know, like this Kahneman guy at Stanford. He just published this book. It's a big bestseller. It's called "It's Hopeless." You think you've made a choice, but your brain chose before you even thought about it. He has a book like that. You're helpless. Yeah, it's like you can't make a free decision. There's no free.
He's at Stanford, is he?
Yeah, I think he's at Stanford.
I think he's.
It's a thing about how your mind. You know, your unconscious is functioning.
And
everything you do. It doesn't matter. I don't mean it doesn't matter. But they always write books like that. Darwin, you don't know what you're doing. Your genes are telling you. Do something. Go to Menla. Don't go to Menla. That's all just, you're just a slave of your genes. Marx, you're a slave of your social position in society. Freud, you're a slave of your unconscious. There's no choice. You can't do anything, so you might as well vote Republican. That's the way you're educated, okay? So the reason I'm saying going into this is because, you know, Buddhism tends to be taught, rightly in a way, to sort of free yourself from being trapped in conceptuality and imaginative patterns and world structures, to try to go and experience the actual reality of things beyond conceptuality. It does do that. And although the most sophisticated way of doing that is to use the only one that really works to a deep level is to use conceptuality to free yourself from conceptuality. Just suppressing your conceptualizing mechanisms and thinking that you're sitting there, ding, that only temporarily suppresses them. And then when they come back, you behave like badly. Like the famous guy that I always remember at Barry that Sharon talks about, who left down the street from Barry muttering inconsolably and angrily, "It doesn't work. It didn't work," right? After a retreat. Like there was something that would work, some sort of gimmick or strategy or mechanism or practice that would work, rather than he's the one who's doing the work. Right? There's like that. So that's the point. But there's also a point, you know, that's the deep, getting beyond and finding, experiencing true reality in a direct experience way, experiential or experimental or experiential way, is, of course, a major, major foundational. That's the wisdom side. But then there is the imaginative side about seeing alternative versions of the nature of reality. Nirvana, there's no reality beyond the relative realities, actually. In non-dualism means that the ultimate reality is the relative realities. But there are sectors of the relative reality that are filled with suffering, dominated by ignorance. And then when you recreate that and reshape that relative reality using wisdom as the energy to reshape it, there's a blissful area of reality, what they call a Buddha land or a Buddhaverse, a land of love and bliss and generosity and so forth.